The Orthodox Christian Network is honored to present the following recording from the Orthodox Christian Association of Medicine, Psychology, and Religion's 2013 Annual Conference. Care of the Aging Patient, a Pastoral Perspective, delivered by Father Anthony Ugolnik.
And for our last presentation this morning, which is the pastoral aspect, the introducer will be the Vice President of OCAMPER, Gail Walalchuk. And by the way, you've heard three talks now, last night and this morning, too, three total. If you are not a member of OCAMPER, this is what we do. I hope you will give serious thought to joining if you're not. Now, the Vice President of OCAMPER and a friend of mine for years, Gail Walalchuk.
And you can tell he's a friend because he doesn't say how many years that is, so thanks, John. You know, it's really my thrill to be able to introduce our next speaker. I first encountered Father Anthony Ugolnik through his book, The Illuminating Icon. I remember reading that book and just thinking, whoa, this man is so deep, this is incredible, I want to meet him one day. And it was my great joy when he became a member of our diocese, when our archdiocese joined together in the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, and he became a priest within the Ukrainian Orthodox Archdiocese. That, for me, was a real thrill. In any case, he is the Emeritus Kresge Professor of Ethics and Humanities at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. He's the pastor of Holy Ghost Ukrainian Orthodox Church in Coatesville, Pennsylvania. He has publications that are very broad, literature, theology, the arts. He's been a visiting scholar at the Theological Academy in St. Petersburg, at the Center for Theological Research at Princeton, as a board member and scholar of the Ecumenical Institute at St. John's University in Abbey in Minnesota. He also says that his maybe perhaps most significant experience is that he's been a primary caregiver for three aging relatives over the past 25 years. And as you heard last night, he's also a former hockey coach. Please join me in welcoming Father Anthony Ugolnik.
Glory be to Jesus Christ. It is, does one feel an obligation to be deep? You know, that's a very flattering description. Thank you, Gail, very much. If I am deep, I don't know why I enjoy shallow places so very much. You know, Las Vegas and Key West are probably two of my favorite places in the United States. I want to read, before I begin, the abstract that I sent, and it was also available on the web, but I just want to read it because it'll tell you where I'm going. The respect, the even reverence that is paid to age and social tradition and in Scripture, sacred to most traditions, is not due to anything intrinsic in age itself. It's due to the use to which age is put. The elderly have been deprived among us of their usefulness to those whom they love. A part of that tragic deprivation is due to the aged themselves. The cult of retirement, in quotes, has created a sense of entitlement to absolute leisure. Secondly, a part of that deprivation is due to an imperial technology. Those who have not mastered the device and code of the moment literally do not exist in the minds of those who have. And finally, a part of that deprivation is due to the specifics of the healthcare industry around us. The elderly are warehoused in institutions that separate them rather than integrate them into the larger culture in which we live. And here's the ending, for which I must apologize. The solution lies in the hearts and the resolution of the aged themselves. We all will grow old and we have lost that crucial empathy. We must reclaim the use to which we once were put at any age and restore the hope that faith in God brings to life in us, regardless of the years we bear. I don't apologize for those because of what they say, but because I really didn't mean them as I said it. I was just filling space because I didn't quite know where I was going to go. And being an English professor, I can do that, you know, with great insincerity. I just threw some words around. And now I hope I can make good, you know, on the words that that I uttered at that point. Some of what I intended to say has been covered, so I'm going to try to, you know, digest those parts of the papers previously given. I got to begin by thanking you, your Grace, and all of you individually for inviting me. I have no expertise in this area. As the introduction indicated, I'm used to talking about literature, the arts, the intersection of theology, Byzantine influences, and Old English literature, and Old Norse, that kind of thing. So I have no qualification in this area professionally, but a lot of experience. I myself am now older. I've been subjected to the ritual of retirement. Last year, I'm an emeritus. I still teach on occasion, but I'm not regularly teaching a roster of students. I've spent the 25 years in elder care, and my family has. 14 years for the aunt who liked her fingernails painted, the mentally, handicapped aunt, who also acted as a mother to me in my youth, incidentally. And then 11 to 12 years for both parents. I eventually lost one, my dad, to Alzheimer's. And finally, I lost my mother. One interesting thing is that they lived exactly the same number of days on this earth. My mother was younger than my dad, and she died precisely the number of years and months later. You know, that she was young. So, like other clergy, I do a lot of funerals and rehab, nursing home visitations, and I talk a lot to people who share the same problems that I had, that is, those who are given to elder care. We touched upon the depression that those who administer elder care experience. In other words, it's not only the elderly themselves, but those who give them care. And that I know very well. And, I have to admit to you that in that area, I have, as I suspect many have, I have sinned. That is, that, I gave the care very dutifully, but it was often with masked resentment, feigned good cheer, and internal anguish. And a lot of people who confess to me blame themselves for the same thing. And there are, overwhelming feelings of guilt and reverberating and, resentments and old conflicts that bubble upward with that extended care. And that's something with which we have to deal and we have to be honest about and address. I named the outline in the talk Unplanned Obsolescence. And that's derived from the practice of a lot of manufacturers in making appliances and automobiles with a targeted date at which they will become useless, so you'll buy another one. You know, a lot of, in our consumer society, they devote a lot of time to that. And so if cars and appliances are designed to fail, to lose their usefulness, the elderly also, it seems to me, become obsolete. And they didn't really plan for that part of the experience. So that quality, that dimension of obsolete being is a feature of contemporary life. Use has either been abandoned or lost to us in our elder years, not only in the U.S., but also in those cultures, those ones we deem traditional, the Asian cultures. Among those who have immigrated to the U.S., those immigrants complain of diminishing respect for the elderly among themselves once they come here. And even in those nations themselves, in Japan and China, the Philippines, reverence for the elderly is diminishing. as they enter the larger world market. And our prejudice against the elderly, as well as that reverence, has something to do with the stereotypes we assign to the old. Research by the Elderly American Society reveals 9 major stereotypes, and I'll just run through them rapidly. But each of them, although they're negatively envisioned in our society, have a positive mirror in those societies that reverence age. Illness, impotence, ugliness, mental decline, mental illness, uselessness, isolation, poverty, and finally depression, which we've given a lot of attention to. And in the stereotypes that are given, or the cultural signals, kind of the semiotic significations of old age, in those traditional societies, those have counterparts. Impotency, that is, the inability to generate, is compensated for or replaced with the idea that the elderly care and nurture the youth and nurture the offspring. Ugliness, that's, of course, culturally assigned. The elderly are not viewed as repulsive in traditional societies. The mental decline and mental illness, they're replaced with a kind of an idea that the elderly are shrines of wisdom, and isolation is replaced with integration, because the elderly have a role in the family groups and in the village and in the societies to which these people belong. So the core of our negative depiction of the elderly and of age is exile and isolation. As elderly lose integration, they can lose a certain self-esteem, a sense of worth, and lament for losses. That's the problem of growing old in our society, in all its spiritual dimensions. And it's a problem destined to grow. This hasn't been covered in the talks that have been given, probably because it's self-evident. But the Census Bureau reveals in the last census that more Americans, 65 plus, there are more Americans over 65 on any given day than there were the day before in our country. It's up 15.1% from in the last 10 years, from 2000 to 2010. The percent of elderly men is also increasing with longevity. And the proportion of the population itself increasing in age is the largest in the Northeast, but it's increasing virtually everywhere. And the problems of the elderly, of course, increase with advancing age. Disproportionate rates of suicide, we've already heard about, illness, dementia, Alzheimer's, and the crisis is exacerbated by the increasing number of elderly with insufficient savings and resources. My parents were depleted of savings and of money much sooner than they expected to be. My dad was a welder. He didn't have a great income. My mom picked up a little money here and there, with a number of jobs, but they simply had not amassed enough savings, and they depended on Social Security pension, which my dad lost because of the bankruptcy of the factory that he worked for, and other misfortunes that they faced just left them depleted. My aunt was never a so-called productive member of society. She never really worked, and so she had only Medicaid to depend upon. And to be left without resources in old age is really a tragic condition in our society, trust me, because I've dealt with the problems arising from it. There's a limit to what children can contribute financially to the elderly in their later years, because, it's like I was a medic in the Army during the Vietnam War. I mean, it dealt with burn cases and, you know, multiple trauma. And they practice some horrible thing called triage. You know, you got to decide who you give your attention to, who's likely to live, who's likely to die. And people face that every day in a way, because if they got to raise kids and educate them, and then they have elderly to take care of two whose resources are dwindling, where do you put the money at the time in which that person requires care that you can no longer give them? You know, there's a vast difference in the quality of homes, you know, that are offered to people in assisted living. And also in nursing homes, too, depending on how much, you know, how many savings you bring. And if you want to assure the quality of care to your mother or your dad that you think they deserve, you know, you got to dig in to your own savings, if you have them, to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you just got to lay on the table. You'll never get it back. You know? It's an awful dilemma. An awful dilemma to be in. And a lot of us will face it as the years go by. The elderly seek to hang on to independent living. 13% were of one-person households in the U.S. in 1960. It's 30% now, and half of that increase is due to the elderly living alone, not just young people, you know, leaving the house. As a matter of fact, young people are going back, have gone back home with the shrinking resources, you know, in our society. So if we, let's look at the context, why this increase in obsolescence and estrangement from those younger than themselves, and I'm speaking of our larger society now, not necessarily of our individual Orthodox communities. Let's look at the self-imposed dimension, the extent to which the elderly have, and I'll use the word estranged themselves, you know, from those who are younger than they are. The cult of retirement is something that I drew attention to, and I call it a cult because, you know, it really is pervasive, and it's something that it's even assigned to you. If you've ever been retired from a position and they have a party to celebrate your career, you really feel yourself, you know, being sort of estranged, right, from those who are complimenting you. I reviewed on the internet and in gift shops t-shirts, plaques, license plates devoted to those that are retired, and some of them are, I got, you know, baseball cap. I'm retired, so every day is a weekend. And then a t-shirt with a golf course in the background. I'm retired. This is my new office. Another one, a plaque. I'm retired. Leave me alone. And my particular favorite, you know, retired teacher, : every child left behind. Oh, now that, you know, the message there, you know, the semiotics of that is pretty clear. You know, leave me alone. You know, I'm not a part of this anymore. And the other is residence. Residence. And this is a touchy subject, I know. But age-restricted communities have grown among us so rapidly. The first one I could find was in 1954. And since then, they blossomed, bloomed. You know, the biggest legal problem that age-restricted communities now face is the effort to keep young people out. You know, they don't want children in them. And the displacement of population also to other climates and other places. You know, the elderly emigrate to Florida, Arizona, less now than in California. And I remember in my own family the kind of crisis we went through, that as soon as I started having kids, you know, my parents moved to Florida. I didn't want them to move to Florida. I really didn't want them to. I have to admit that. But they wanted to go. And so my children's association with their grandparents was not as close and intimate as mine was. They saw them sometimes for extended periods when they came to stay with me, But, you know, they were intermittent contacts and not the constant ones that I long for. And now as a granddad myself, you know, I got grandkids in West Hollywood. You know, so I got to buy everything on you know, U.S. Air credit cards so that I can get free tickets, you know, and bonus miles to go out to see them. I can only see them four times, maybe five times a year. This is the emigration retirement is voluntary separation, and the living in age-restricted communities is to some extent the same thing. There's also, of course, involuntary separation and isolation, but we'll get to that in a moment. And the second dimension I wanted to cover first, and that's this imperial technology that I was talking about. The number of seniors who are wired is increasing. Recent data is sparse, but I did find this, that as of April 2012, 53% of those between 65 and 75 use the internet, 34% use Facebook, but that after age 75, that drops dramatically. It drops really dramatically. And the primary use of wired technology among older people is email, and that's falling out of fashion, you know, with the younger, of course, because they're wired to each other in different ways, and text messaging is probably the best example of that. And, you know, Twitter, too, to a degree. But the number of, well, older people, I was going to say my wife included, but she's younger than I am. It annoys my wife that I text. I mean, I have to say that. She doesn't like it, you know, because we'll be talking to each other, and I'll feel that insistent little buzz, you know, in my pocket, and I just got to see who it is. I've got to pay attention to it. And kids that withdraw, if you notice, you know, from any situation they're in order to, you know, be texting each other. So they'll be taking part in the social event, but that society that's conveyed, you know, by that medium, whether it be a cell phone or iPad or whatever, that's more important to them. It's more insistent to them than the actual interaction in the moment. And you can have whatever reaction to that or condemnation of it you want, it's still a fact. You know, we're shaped and defined by our relationships with each other, and to Gen X, existence is in large part shaped by that internet connection. So we are then, or seniors are, obsolete in that sense in shaping their relationships. We have to have face-to-face for a validation of the reality of that connection, but for them, you know, the texting, the tweeting, and the wire connection is important, and in some sense it defines the importance of the existence of the other person. So the elderly cease to be, in some sense. I have all other figures on use of the internet, but I'll skip over them because I want to get to the theological dimension of this presentation. I'll give brief attention to the healthcare system that warehouses the elderly in institutions that separate them rather than integrate them into the larger culture. I wanted to cover something that wasn't touched upon in the previous two presentations, and that's a personal dilemma that can face those who care for the elderly. Let's say you can no longer care for a beloved person at home. There's guilt involved in that too. But if you can no longer do it, they go to another level of care. It's very difficult to find one. And generally, they go to something in the assisted living category. And in Pennsylvania, assisted living does not get you, you know, the same sort of public benefits and assistance that it will if you go to nursing care. Nonetheless, people don't want to go to nursing homes. They want to stay in assisted living, especially if they're married. And they can stay together in assisted living. If they go to many nursing home places, they can't, especially if one has Alzheimer's and the other does not, right? And they want to stay together, but they'll separate. and they don't want to be separated. And so it's a horrible dilemma. If somebody is hospitalized, and I've been through this a number of times, before they're dismissed, they have to pass a kind of a test. And that test determines whether they are deemed to be worthy to go or skilled enough to go back to assisted living, or must they go, to a nursing home. It's tremendously anxious for everybody involved. You know that the fate of your loved one is in the hands of somebody who's making that adjudication, and you can't really argue with them. So, are they capable of going back? Where are they going to go? Rehab? Where? What place? What place? Assisted living? Nursing home? What kind of nursing home do you go to? All of that depends on how much money you got. All of it depends on how much money you got. That's my practical, answer to that question. And I visit a lot of those places as a priest. And the level of care, the surroundings, the attentiveness, of the caregivers, it differs dramatically in all of those places. The less money you have, the lower the quality of care that you get. And so there, in our lives, there's a long, sometimes not so slow, migration to a nursing home. And in that nursing home, that kind of enforced sense of obsolescence. 21% of women, 11.6% of men over 85 are in nursing homes. 3.5% of people 75 to 85. 1% 65 to 75. And the Census Bureau and the NIH, both say that 20 to 30% of us can expect to spend some time in our lives in that environment. And the percent of reported that happiness and depression is very high. Staff are underpaid and overworked. And I'm sorry, but there is a tendency in caregiving to those give care, to these people, to infantilize them in some way, to treat them like children. And Gail mentioned that with people not believing, her father. And nothing annoyed my mother more than having something say to her, "Well, we're having a good day today, aren't we?" And she said, "I'm not in kindergarten, please, there is that tendency. So, all right, these are the problems. Now, what's our response as pastoral caregivers? Of what should we be aware? Well, the good news has already been covered, that integration into church communities is a part of the solution. It's only a part, but it's a part of the solution. It was fascinating to me in reviewing, doing the research for this and reviewing the figures, that virtually all surveys focus on church attendance in its relationship to longevity rather than happiness. I mean, I didn't hear much discussed about happiness, but people live longer. I guess that presumes they're happier too. Duke University study, seniors who regularly attend church have a 28% lower death rate. People with more positive attitudes about age live 7.5 years longer. All of them are connected somehow with how long you live. But a study of people in longest lived community in the U.S., which is Loma Linda, California, is really interesting. Most of the people in that community are SDA, Seventh-day Adventists, and they attribute their longevity to activity, eating less, a plant-heavy diet, active participation in a community, and a sense of life purpose, because SDAs are vegetarian. So the church in itself can't address the problems of separation, but the church certainly can help. And I got to raise a caution here. The Gallup polls report that 40% of the American population attends church regularly, and we hear ourselves sometimes touted as the most religious of developed nations. But the Olson poll, with more precise data, reveals a halo effect That is, people report that they go to church much more often than they really do. And the real study is that in 2004, 17.7% of the whole population attended a Christian church on any given weekend. And the Journal of Scientific Study, Religion, confirms that the number is dwindling rapidly in proportion to the growth of the population. That is, that church attendance stays steady since 1990. The same numbers go in the population, but the population increases. And inactive Protestants, those who say they're Protestant but never go to church, is about 80%. And the young are the ones, of course, who bail out. There's a tendency among people as they grow older to go back to church, to go back to their religious roots to some extent, but it's not really that great of a percentage. So, what are the pastoral issues? Now, I got two groups of them. I got half hour right left. And I would love to have some reaction to this too. I'll deal first with my research, pastoral research from interdenominational sources. These are not Orthodox-specific sources. These are strategies that people, have come up with and published about with respect to pastoral care for the elderly. The directors of institutions and caregivers in general, those who take care of the elderly in institutions, are supported of the need for pastoral care, but they claim no responsibility for providing it. They'll try to facilitate it if they can, but basically it's, hands off. It's the pastor's duty himself, to involve themselves with those people. And if he wants to, they won't stand in the way. And it's a different reaction on the part of hospitals. And those of you who are physicians, maybe you'll have another reaction to this. I don't know. But my experience is that I'm kind of an adjunct whenever I go, to hospitals. And I'm presumed to be there for end-of-life issues, even by some of the patients. I had the experience last week of walking into a hospital room, and it wasn't the person I expected, and I said, I guess I'm in the wrong room. And the guy said, yeah, you certainly are. You certainly are. Stay away from me. This black angel of death, sweeps through the hallway. And we spoke about our hesitancy as a culture to deal with death. To deal with death as an issue. And we're associated with death. So where does that put us? And if we talk to our own people, and I'm talking about our own people now, maybe this is a confession, I don't know, but when I go to talk to my parishioners who are in the hospital and ill, I spend maybe 10% of the time talking about spiritual issues and 90% of the time rehearsing their therapies. They want to tell me what medicine they're taking, what the doctor says to do next. They want to explain all this with urgency. I understand that. But my function, my spiritual function, comes last. And when I give them the sacrament, which should be the culmination, right, of my visit, that is isolated in large measure from the rest of the conversation. When we're there, I try, to bring the subject back to that. But there's a hesitancy. And as far as dealing with issues of death, that's extraordinarily difficult to approach unless the person has been already diagnosed as terminal and they're under hospice care. Hospice is very helpful in confronting that issue. They're helpful to me as well as to the patient. So pastoral goals and tools, these are enumerated in a series of studies. Number one, the need to find meaning and purpose in life and articulate it to some level. the need to feel a sense of belonging and love, the need to find reconciliation with God and human community, overcome resentments, and so on. And I would add a number four, the need to find a relationship between the suffering and pain one is experiencing and the spirituality that one is schooled in and experiences. And here are some tools that were come up with, and we've heard some of them already, interestingly enough. Attention to and promoting a process of life review. That would be the reminiscence, I think, right? That Dr. O'Reilly was talking about. Memory function in traditional societies. Excuse me, what I mean is that in traditional societies, one of the functions that older people perform is that they are the memory of the community, a kind of a living tradition. You know, they are, you know, the step and the legacy of what has been given to us before. But memory also confers identity. Each of us has a narrative, a narrative, a biography, you know, a self-autobiography that we assign to ourselves. And that's a part of who it is and who we perceive it is that we are. And so it's a role of a pastor and a church community, you know, to foster that. And what some pastors do is sustain a kind of a life journal, which one can keep up, you know, as you go to a visit. Ask the kind of questions that Dr. O'Reilly had given us. And you know, we can ask them with a specifically spiritual focus, a specifically parish-centered focus, and kind of keep a record, right, of what it is that we hear so that we can allude to it the next time. Another really interesting technique that I use in my communities is to send the kids to interview older parishioners in order to develop a kind of a history, right, of the community, kind of a history that a class can come up with in a year. So they go and talk to older people about what things used to be like, what it was like to be a teenager when they were kids. Did they have this problem? Did they have that problem? And my church had a centennial celebrated a few years back, and that was a part, you know, of our effort. And one parishioner can be assigned the task, if they're writing the history of the parish, of document what it is that the elderly have to contribute. In senses of belonging and love, of course, you get visits, pastoral visits, the exercise of establishing a presence, and that word presence has been used a couple of times in these presentations, not just pleasantries, but making a person feel listened to. And I think that's really important. The first thing one hears often are complaints, right? If you ask them, how are things going? There's a whole series of complaints. They come first, but we must endure them. You know, we have to endure them, but we can probe beneath the complaints themselves. Variety of visitors is important, a variety of agents that go to see the person, even the use of pets and little animals, cards from kids in Sunday school to assign kids in your parish, you know, to write cards, send cards to the people so that they feel included. And connection to the body is important as well. The nails, right? You meant that the kids had to hold the hands, right? Or the people that were older. But touching, stroking the person insofar as it's you know, appropriate and welcomed, anointing the Eucharist, as much ritual as can be expressed. We've talked about the separation from our communal bodily, I mean, our worship together as a community. I've had my choir, or three or four people in the choir, come, you know, to a nursing home, making the arrangement to be there, so that we can have, you know, a malevolent or Acathist or something, you know, at the home, and chanted, and boy, that made a big impression. You know, they invited their friends to come to it. It was really an event, you know, in the life not only of them but of some people that they welcomed to come. And whatever tasks that they can still perform in conjunction with the community and reconciliation with God and others. That's really the part I think that we can contribute most, is that act of reconciliation. Because in the exploration of memory are going to come regrets. You know, and I've experienced them, deep and profound. Regrets of mine, regrets of my parents. My aunt was easy to take care of. I mean, she was the easiest one because she was just a child, you know, and really pure delight. She would laugh at my jokes even if I told them, you know, each time. I just felt, you know, like I could really make her happy. My parents were much harder to deal with. They didn't like being under my direction, you know, and fought it, you know, every step of the way. My dad and I had issues in our lives that were really deep-seated. They were partially reconciled at the end of life. But I can tell you my dad was a veteran of World War II. He fought at Battle of Bulge. He suffered a great deal from what we later recognized as PTSD, post-traumatic stress. And, you know, as when I was a kid, he was an alcoholic and a drug abuser later, would disappear for periods of time. I didn't know where he went as a kid. I didn't find out until I was an adult that he had been hospitalized in those interims, because my mom was acting like everything was all normal, everything was okay, you know, kind of covering for everything. So we had this deep sort of hostility, you know, to each other, anger toward each other. And I was so mad at him for not paying attention to me, you know, and being absorbed with, you know, his alcohol or drugs or whatever was going on at the time. And then at the end of his life, you know, he and I reviewed our military experiences together, because I had my own issues, you know, to deal with. I mean, dealing with burn cases and multiple amputees is not a pleasant thing. You know, it messes you up. And I didn't have an easy time either for the first few years after I got into the military. And realizing that we had that same experience was a kind of a watershed for us in repairing our relationship. The point is that everybody's got baggage, and that the act of repentance is a part of the exercise of memory. And that's a place at which the pastor can be of tremendous influence, paying greater attention to confession, active role in trying to promote reconciliation, especially reconciliation with those from whom one has been estranged. I don't know if it's only because, you know, I'm Slavic, you know, but people bear grudges, you know, and they take them with them for a long time in life, right? And I've had, it's so funny because, you know, I've heard confessions in East Europe too. And they're very different in the sins they confess, but one sin is, one approach is, come. They'll tell me, I can't forgive my sister. Let's say that for example. I can't forgive my sister. I just feel such resentment for her father. I can't forgive her. But you should hear what she did to me. She did this, and when my mother was dying, she did that, and I did this, and I did that. And then most of the confession is given, you know, to confessing what the sister did. You know, and you got to turn the attention. What did you do? What did you do? How are you going to deal with this? Well, I'll pray for her, but I'm not going to talk to her. You know, that kind of thing. You got to work at that, you know, at the end of life. Yesterday, I was going to come to the executive board meeting just to listen, you know, to what was going on, but I hate to confess it, but I got involved in a novel by Kent Haruf called Benediction, which is about somebody growing older in a little Colorado town, way in the boonies, and it's about simple, small-town life and about an older man as he's dying, reviewing the things in his life which he regrets. And it's a masterful book, very simple book, and it's great to read. And as far as integration into community is concerned, I want to recommend another novel. It's by a Mormon guy called Brady Udall. You might recognize the name because he's got a bunch of politicians in his family, too. But Brady Udall wrote a book called The Life of Edgar Mint. And he spent a couple of, you know, months coming to my church. And I didn't know why he was there, because he's Mormon. He wasn't interested in being Orthodox. He's kind of a Jack Mormon anyhow, not really into his own faith, you know. But he was fascinated with the parish and the dynamics of the parish, and he kept coming. And then he even wanted to come behind the altar, you know, to see what I did back there. And then he sat in the congregation and everything. And his reactions, I even remember, you know, boy, you guys really kiss a lot, you know. You can hug each other and hold each other and stuff like that. You know, my grandma didn't kiss me until, I don't know, you know, she was in her 80s. The novel ends with this guy. Now, the guy never converts or anything, but he's an American, Native American kid, right, who's abandoned, and goes through a whole litany of foster homes. And the story is about how he ends up with an older lady in a Pennsylvania town going to a Ukrainian, I'm happy to say, Orthodox church. And it's very brief, the ending, but it talks about his life and how he finds a place here. He's not a believer. He doesn't receive communion. But yes, he does receive a communion, you know, with the people that are there. And he talks about kissing and hugging, you know, people, and how ready they are to do that for him. Now, I got a few minutes to get to the Orthodox dimension of this, because when I finished talking about this same subject at a clergy conference, one of my colleagues said to me, reminded me of some stuff that we had discussed together, which I'd even written about. And he said, what about our anthropology? You know, what about educating our people too? What it means to be a person? Because you talk about obsolescence. Obsolescence has some sort of connection to usefulness and utility. And of course, that's connected to individualism. And that's all a function, you know, of the culture that we live in. But we have, you know, our own Orthodox anthropology, which is a response to that. And we don't educate our people. We don't educate them specifically to that dimension of living. And he was so right. You know, God is Trinity, with which our liturgy resonates, has radical implications for theological anthropology. And it's not as fancy as it sounds. I mean, we can view Trinity in sort of a, you know, a philosophical and very distant manner, but it is dynamic. You know, God's being is persons in communion. Father Hopko always used to say, God alone is not God. God's being is persons in communion, again. And we live in a pale sort of reflection of that communion. And the Romanian theologian, Staniu, talks about this to some extent. It was really radical for me when I first encountered it. But, you know, we ourselves, in our interaction, in our loving interaction, are a pale reflection of that inner life of the Trinity. We are constituted as persons by our interrelationship with each other. And you can communicate that to people without being, you know, excessively intellectual or fancy. And you can communicate to people who aren't even believers or strong believers. Because I spend most of my life with people who don't believe much. You know, academics, God knows, don't believe a whole lot except, you know, in themselves. And the many of my students are religiously illiterate. But I encountered a guy, a philosopher, a literary critic in Russia by the name of Mikhail Bakhtin, and he had to communicate in a Marxist idiom, which made him ironically acceptable to the American Academy, you know, because, hey, he was a Marxist, you know, critic, hey, he's really, you know, he's got really hot stuff here, let's look at what he's got to say. And his central thesis is a sort of a dialogic being, that is that, let's say, my words, as I utter them to you, are not mine any longer. As you receive them, they become yours. And in some sense, then, in that space between us, they are ours. So we shape each other, each hand is the hand that sculpts, you know, the other. Well, my Marxist-inclined colleagues found that really exciting and really interesting. And when I told him, hey, he was a really religious guy, he published on the Trinity before, and he had to, you know, apologize for it the rest of his life. And he was really, religiously active, not openly, but, clandestinely, almost, through his entire professional life. And he was openly associated with the seminarians during those Soviet years at the academy. He had a very orthodox view of the world. He published a lot on Dostoevsky. He had a very orthodox view of the world in a secular context. And, there are ways that we can get these concepts that are so vital to us across to people who don't share the idiom of our tradition, but who may, in some sense, share its spirit. If we look at this thing of utility, I'm no longer useful, right? I have no more usefulness. I remember in Russia hearing a paper on Bulgakov and the Orthodox work ethic. It was an interesting paper because Russia accused itself in those days of not having a work ethic, not only because of socialism, but because of the legacy of serfdom, and that kind of passivity that you see among the peasantry in pre-revolutionary Russia. It's covered in Tolstoy. Kind of disappointed him. He had a hard time dealing with it. But Bulgakov defined the work ethic in terms of communal rather than individual value. What one does then in concrete terms is of less value than what one contributes to loving interrelationship. Loving interrelationship. So the community loves, and by virtue of its love, it produces. And the church, of course, is a worshiping community, is the source and matrix of our theology. We have a communal emphasis on personhood as opposed to individual self-definition. And so it's important to integrate the elderly into our worship, and our relationship with them should be focused upon, that liturgical understanding, not necessarily liturgy as an activity, but liturgy is as an event, but liturgy is a lived experience. And so personhood, what is personhood? Well, it's defined by virtue of our interaction, and also it accomplishes a kind of a self-transcendence from the limitations of nature. If we view the importance of theosis in our theology, theosis growing into God, that can be preached, it can be integrated into ministry in such a way, that we see ourselves in process through the whole experience of living and growing toward a kind of a culmination that we may never really reach, because one of the fathers says, even in the next world we grow from glory to glory, I think it's Gregory. The process itself is the dynamic of our lives. And in that sense, then, as we grow older, we can, through the sanctity that we strive to possess, through our mindfulness, not only of each other, but of God, we can grow closer and closer, to that Godhead. And in conclusion, I wanted to say that longing for something is a part of the human condition. And we can see that longing is a dynamic in the writing of a lot, of our Orthodox theologian philosophers, particularly the more recent ones. One of my favorite expressions of it is if I can be, nonpartisan here, is from a Ukrainian Pamphil, who was a teacher of Solovyov. He's got a beautiful treatise on prayer of the heart, which talks about, the prayer of the heart is that which unites us to each other. And longing is a part of the human condition, so that yearning, striving, missing, even regretting what is lost is in that sense a desire for completeness in God. The longing is in itself not an eternal absence, but an ascent, a growth toward the true enjoyment of that which is desired. And we have the hope, a much neglected virtue. The hope. And it's got to be stronger, you know, when we minister to the elderly. The hope that desire will be satisfied. So, thanks for your patience. And, you know, yes. Yeah.
So, Father, this like longing and this like yearning for prayer, there's a sense in which it requires a type of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how you relate that to a person that is having dementia. I mean, you've experienced that in your own family as well. How do you kind of relate that to that situation?
I think you've got to be with the person for a while. You know, we were talking about limitations of time, and we experience it too. But I think it's better to visit a person less often, but visit them for a longer time personally. You know, that's what I try to do. But, you know, you can find your way with people who have a dementia. You can find your way if you spend a lot of time with them. And it has something to do with, you know, also regrets. I'm not giving you a clear answer, but if I had more time, I could. I told someone about an encounter with my aunt at the very end of her life. She, too, had been abused. She'd been raped. She was a young woman, you know, extraordinarily beautiful in her youth, and mentally handicapped, and placed in conditions where men could take advantage of her. One of them in my own family, you know. One of them, and a person in my own family. And when she opened up to me about that having happened to her, she said, you know, I said to her, you're so good. You know, I was affirming her. You're so sweet. You know, you're so wonderful. You know, you're going to go to heaven, because she knew she was dying at the time. And we practiced waiting, you know, because I said, you're going to be a queen. And she said, I can't be a queen. And I said, why not? She says, I can't wear a crown. And I said, look at Elizabeth. You've got to wave like this when you go in heaven, you know. So we were practicing waiting. But she said, I'm not good. I'm not good. And I said, why? She said, I did bad things. And then she cried. And all of this poured out of her. All of this poured out of her. And she was longing her entire life for some sense of forgiveness for that. She blamed herself for something of which she was totally innocent. You know? And it wasn't words that conveyed the forgiveness. It was an embrace. You know? Just embrace and reassurance. And all of us have longing. Demented people have longings. And sometimes their dementia is a circle around that longing. You know, my dad in his last months, you know, circled over and over and over again around his Army experience. It was like he couldn't resolve it. He couldn't, you know, like come to terms with it. There were some things that had happened to him during, you know, that. He had a Silver Star, that's it. But he, you know, he regretted, I'm convinced, the fact that he killed, right? That he killed. So his longing was to somehow transcend that and to be forgiven, to be forgiven.
For more information on OCamper, please visit their website at OCAMPR.org. This has been the Orthodox Christian Network reporting, myocn.net.